The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Back in the 1980s, most people's first glimpse of an individual with autism was a character named Raymond, played by Dustin Hoffman in the 1988 Oscar-winning film Rain Man.
A2.
It's a lot more than A2, too. Thanks, Raymond.
But 246 total.
The change. How many toothpicks, Raymond?
250.
Pretty close.
246.
There's four left in the box.
Today, the CDC estimates that about one in 68 children has been identified falling somewhere along the spectrum of the autism spectrum disorder, or ASD. And as more and more people are being diagnosed with ASD, the push to find out what causes it and the search for a cure has increased. Meanwhile, a parallel movement is developing that regards autism not as a pathology or a disorder, but as neurological diversity that should be recognized and respected as a social category. Steve Silberman has covered science and cultural affairs for Wired and several other publications for more than 20 years. His new book is called Neurotribes: The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. And Steve, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much, Virginia. It's great to be here.
Now, how do you define neurodiversity?
Well, the most succinct, I would say, summation of it that I've heard, and in fact recently, is great minds don't always think alike. So for a long time, we've considered conditions like dyslexia, ADHD, and autism only as sort of checklists of deficits. But it turns out that every one of those conditions also conveys certain cognitive advantages. For instance, autistic people are able to focus for a long time on tasks that interest them. They often have very good recall of facts, and they're good at detecting flaws and visual patterns. So what neurodiversity says is that we should start looking at people's strengths as well as the things that challenge them and the things that they find difficult. And that can be in school, for instance. Every parent of an autistic child knows how difficult IEP meetings can be. And one of the things that is very rough for both parents and kids about IEP meetings is that it's usually just going over what the kid can't do. Well, every child also has distinctive strengths. And so what if we started adding noticing the child's strengths to IEP meetings so that lessons could be customized for what truly engages them and what helps them feel capable and helps engage their natural interests. So I would say that neurodiversity is a way of looking at these conditions that takes into account their strengths as well as the challenges that they present. And I think it's been a little bit overhyped to say that, oh, you know, things like autism are just cognitive variations. Well, obviously, autism is a disability. And all of these conditions are disabilities. But a disability is something that society can also make accommodations for.
Well, tell us a little bit about this kind of origins of the neurodiversity movement and what its goals are.
Well, the word neurodiversity was invented by an anthropology grad student in Australia named Judy Singer. And she came up with it in the course of some conversations with one of the first online discussion groups for autistic people in the late 90s. And what they were talking about was, you know, the diagnosis was basically not available to adults until the 80s and 90s. And once adults were able to get a diagnosis as being on the spectrum, I mean, the spectrum didn't even exist before the 80s, actually. But once adults started identifying themselves as autistic, they rejected the notion that every single one of their fascinations and interests and abilities were just signs of pathology. And so they wanted to find a way to basically talk about autism that was free of the medical psychopathological context. And so she coined the word neurodiversity in the spirit of phrases like black is beautiful or gay is good. And she wanted to build a bridge between autism and the disability rights community, because the notion that society can accommodate disability is nothing new for people who are blind or deaf or who use wheelchairs. But in autism, that was a very new idea, and in some ways it's still a new idea. So in a way, embedded in the idea of neurodiversity is the notion that society can help relieve some of the most disabling aspects of these conditions by making reasonable accommodations.
So this was in the 1990s. Who are the advocates of the neurodiversity movement today?
Well, I can think of several organizations that are doing excellent work. For instance, the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network has been working at the highest levels in formulation of public policy that will benefit all people on the spectrum. Like some people have heard the word neurodiversity. If they've heard it in an unflattering context, they think that it's only about, you know, so-called shiny Aspies, quote-unquote high-functioning people with, Asperger's syndrome on the mild end of the spectrum. That is not true. Neurodiversity advocacy groups like the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, the Autism Women's Network, they're working for changes in society that will benefit everybody at every point on the spectrum. And so, for instance, ASAN, the group I just mentioned, has just recently persuaded the Department of Transportation to issue guidelines to commercial air carriers to make accommodations for travelers on the spectrum of all ages, both children and adults. Any parent of an autistic kid can tell you that, you know, flying for the first time on a plane can be truly an ordeal. But with some help from the ground crew and some accommodations in the air, it can be a much less stressful experience. And so the accommodations that ASAN has just fought for and won will help all people on the spectrum.
It sounds like all very positive work. So why, then, is there so much controversy behind the neurodiversity movement?
Well, I think a lot of it comes from misunderstanding of what it means. You know, parents are understandably afraid that, you know, somehow talking about the positive aspects of autism will make light of the fact that their children are struggling every day even to tie their own shoes or to go to class, et cetera. Autism is a very, very challenging condition. Anyone who says that autism isn't a disability is not familiar with it, really, I would say. But the other reason why there's some sort of, you know, trash talk about neurodiversity is because some people continue to insist that autism is a unique product of the modern era, whether they blame it on vaccines or GMOs or Wi-Fi or whatever. And by the way, all of those things have been blamed, obviously, for the increase in autism diagnoses. But one of the things that I tried to do in my book was to show why the diagnoses have increased so startlingly in the last 25 years or so. And it is startling. It's completely understandable to me why parents would be absolutely terrified when they see that curve, you know, that upward, like the hockey stick curve in climate change. You know, when they see that curve, it's absolutely terrifying. But that's because they've had no explanation of the fact that what the word autism meant in 1970 is completely different from what it means now. And so in a sense, it's not even the same condition, although the same condition is included in, in 1970, is included in what we now call the autism spectrum. But there are a lot more people who can gain access to a diagnosis now, and that's what's reflected in that hockey stick graph.
Steve Silberman is with us. He's covered science and cultural affairs for more than 20 years. He's got a new book out called Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. You talked about aligning the neurodiversity movement with the Black is Beautiful movement or with gay pride. does this mean that there's a sense of pride about being on the autism spectrum, that would mean that people thought it was unnecessary to look for a cure or causes, but instead work towards understanding and acceptance of this kind of diversity?
Well, here's the thing. We, as a country, the United States, have spent more than $1 billion in the last 10 years searching for either a cause or a cure for autism. Where are those things? In fact, the search in the human genome for candidate genes that may produce autism has been very fruitful. We've found more than 600 candidate genes, but we still don't know which of them causes autism. And in fact, each autistic person is genetically quite unique. So it's not like there's an autism gene that we're going to find. There are many, many different genes. What about the environmental risk factors? That list gets longer every day. And in fact, a science blogger named Emily Willingham, who herself has a kid on the spectrum, once wrote a blog post called "This Just In: Being Alive Linked to Autism." So, we could invest, we could throw another $1 billion, which it's like a full employment plan for, autism geneticists and environmental toxicologists. Or we could say, what if some of that money went to directly supporting autistic people and their families? So, the word cure gets brought up so much. Cure, we should be looking for a cure. We've been looking for a cure for schizophrenia for, 50 years. Where is it? These are all very highly complex, primarily genetic conditions. And so they're not so easily unraveled. So we could pour more and more money into that effort. But if in the meantime, parents are desperately afraid to die because they don't know if they can leave their children alone in the world without help, then we're not really dealing with autism seriously as a society. We're just congratulating ourselves for investing in autism science.
I was speaking with my colleague earlier about your book and the concept of neurotribes. And we were sort of questioning whether this is the brain's evolution, that when we first came into being, human beings needed to be social. We needed those networks in order to live and to survive and strengthen ourselves and give ourselves numbers. Now we don't need those kind of basic survival skills so much, but maybe we need brains that can compute and remember facts. And I'm just wondering if there's any thought on your part that, well, maybe autism spectrum disorder is where our brains need to go.
Well, that is a fascinating thought. I mean, I don't really talk about it in the book much, although I will say that one of the people who brought that up to me actually was Lorna Wing, who is the cognitive psychologist who invented the concept of the autism spectrum. So you're not alone in that field of speculation. The one thing I will say is that I think the really profound thing about the idea of neurodiversity is that it says that some of the same places that the genius of humanity comes from are the same places that some of the most difficult challenges in daily life that humanity faces come from. So our strengths are sort of inextricably intertwined with our impairments as a species. And in fact, there was, this kind of movement of people with Asperger's syndrome who claimed that they were the next stage in evolution. I think evolution just works by trying out lots of different possibilities. And autism has been with us for a very long time. One of the most dangerous myths is that autism just popped out of nowhere in the 1980s. And that's a myth that, was spread by the anti-vaccine movement. And it's wrong. I mean, there were autistic people in institutions for decades before that, or kids and adults who were struggling to get by without a diagnosis, which I write about quite a lot.
Mm-hmm. So, you've been writing about autism for almost 15 years. So what has changed since you first began looking into the autism spectrum?
Well, one thing that's changed is that, when I first started writing about autism, a lot of parents were very excited because they felt that we were on the verge of discovering the autism gene. And, I just explained how, in fact, we've discovered, hundreds, if not thousands, of autism genes. So it turns out that, making the breakthrough that's going to make autism a thing of the past. I think science has come to understand that that was hopeful in certain ways, but completely naive in others, and that autism is a very, very complex condition, and that, you know, while we work on trying to figure out what causes it, because, you know, there's no way we're not going to look into that. It's very interesting, and autism, you know, creates a lot of suffering for families, particularly when social support is lacking. Instead of just pursuing that, I think we should be helping those families to live happier, healthier lives.
Well, Steve Silberman, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Steve Silberman, he's a science and public policy journalist, and his new book is called Neurotribes: The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. You'll find a link to much more on the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When he was just 5 years old, Joshua Littman was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, now classified as an autism spectrum disorder. And while Asperger's robbed him of many social skills, it also played a role in his becoming a member of Mensa at age 9 and an honor roll student at the age of 12. Born in Dorset, England, Joshua and his family moved to the United States soon after his diagnosis. His mother, Sarah Littman, is a journalist and author of several children's books. She describes children with Asperger's as born without social genes. In 2006, Sarah took her son to New York City for a special trip. She gave Joshua a notebook so he could write down 10 questions to ask her when they got to the StoryCorps booth at Grand Central Station. Here's their conversation.
From a scale of 1 to 10, do you think your life would be different without animals?
I think it would be an 8 without animals, because they add so much pleasure to life.
How else do you think your life would be different without them?
I could do without things like cockroaches and snakes.
Well, I'm okay with snakes as long as they're not venomous or like can constrict you or anything.
Yeah, I'm not a big snake person.
But cockroach is just the insect we love to hate.
Yeah, it really is.
Have you ever felt like life is hopeless?
When I was a teenager, I was very depressed. And I think that can be quite common with teenagers who think a lot, you know, and are perceptive.
Am I like that?
You were very much like that.
Do you have any mortal enemies?
I would say my worst enemy is sometimes myself. But I don't think I have any mortal enemies.
You don't have a...
No, I don't. I'm sure probably when I was in middle school, there were people that I felt about the way you feel about him. But... to be honest, I don't really remember well enough.
Have you ever lied to me?
I probably have, but I try not to lie to you, even though sometimes the questions you ask make me uncomfortable.
Like when we go on our walks, some of the questions I might ask.
Yeah, but you know what? I feel it's really special that you and I can have those kind of talks, even if sometimes I feel myself blushing a little bit.
Have you ever thought you couldn't cope with having a child?
I remember when you were a baby, you had really bad colic, so you would just cry and cry. And
what's
I didn't
colic?
Know what... It's when you get this stomach ache and all you do is scream for like 4 hours.
Even louder than Amy does?
You were pretty loud, but Amy's was more high-pitched.
I think it feels like everyone seems to like Amy more, like she's like the perfect little angel.
Well, I can understand why you think that people like Amy more. And I'm not saying it's because of your Asperger's syndrome, but being friendly comes easily to Amy. Whereas I think for you, it's more difficult. But the people who take the time to get to know you love you so much.
Like Ben or Eric or Carlos.
Yeah. And
like I have better quality friends, but less quantity.
I wouldn't judge the quality, but I think...
I mean, like, first thing is, like, Amy loved Claudia, then she hated Claudia, she loved Claudia,
Claudia. Part of that's a girl thing, honey. The important thing for you is that you have a few very good friends. And really, that's what you need in life.
Did I turn out to be the son you wanted when I was born? Like, did I meet your expectations? And
you've exceeded my expectations, sweetie. Because, you know, sure, you have these fantasies of what your child's going to be like, but you have made me grow so much as a parent. Because you think...
Well, I was the one who made you a parent.
You were the one who made me a parent. That's a good point. But also, because you think differently from, you know, what they tell you in the parenting books...
Yeah.
I really had to learn to think out of the box with you, and it's made me much more creative as a parent and as a person, and I'll always thank you for that.
And that helped when Amy was born?
And that helped when Amy was born, but You are just so incredibly special to me. And I'm so lucky to have you as my son.
That was Sarah Littman and her son Joshua at StoryCorps in New York City's Grand Central Station. In 2011, Sarah and Joshua returned to StoryCorps so she could interview him about his first year at college. You'll find a link to listen to both of their conversations, as well as an animated version of their first talk, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Cheryl Glickman is a single 40-something-year-old woman living in Los Angeles. She works for a company that makes self-defense exercise videos. She's got a psychosomatic lump in her throat that prevents her from swallowing and has a nearly obsessive crush on a 60-year-old man who is lusting after a teenaged girl. Cheryl, or more accurately, her ever-chattering brain, narrates The First Bad Man. That's the debut novel of the artist, writer, and filmmaker Miranda July. Maybe you first heard that name when her quirky and charming 2000 film, Me, You, and Everyone We Know, won the special jury prize at Sundance. Since then, she's made a second film, a book of short stories, a messaging app, and has performed all over the world. We spoke to her when the book first came out. It is now out in paperback. So this character, Cheryl Glickman, she is archly funny, I thought anyway. Maybe not on purpose, we imagine, because she's rigidly controlled. Can you tell us about her carefully constructed system, as she calls it, for living alone?
Right. Her system is like the way that she keeps house. And yeah, she lives alone. And I think we all kind of do this, especially when we live alone. Like, you just come up with the most efficient way to do things. So, for example, she doesn't use a bowl or a plate. She just eats right out of the pan to save that amount of dishwashing. And she only has one set of dishes, so they can't accumulate, you know. And there's this thing called carpooling, which is if you're going to move an object to put it, you know, back where it goes in the house, you wait until there's a number of objects that need to go in the same direction, and then you carry them all together. Things like that. Which I should say, like, which sounds so crazy when you isolate them and write them down. But I think people do this kind of thing without thinking.
And it is constantly going on inside of her head, so we know what it is. She's got this inner dialogue that sometimes borders on the delusional, I think. Was indulging in that a fun exercise for you? What was that like for you?
Yeah, it was a joy to write Cheryl. She's sort of like my shadow self that I furiously work to, like, outrun, you know? Like, I have to work very hard all the time every day not to be her.
So she's unfiltered you?
Well, no, she's me if I didn't, like, make things all the time. I mean, I'm making things all the time so that I won't end up being completely inert and alone like her.
Well, you do. You've manifested so much in your life. You know, I'm thinking of this quote from True Detective. I mean, you know, did you watch it, by the way?
I've watched one.
Okay, so the Matthew McConaughey character, he says, life's barely long enough to get good at one thing. And here you are. You write, you've made films, you do performance art, and you make it look kind of easy. Does it just look that way?
Yeah, no, it's as hard as doing just one of those things, which is plenty hard. I mean, I think I myself, if I was listening to the radio and I heard that description, I'd be like, oh, that person isn't taking any of those things seriously, you know, so I'm not going to take that person seriously. I mean, that's actually how I feel when I hear that. But all I can say is I just started out that way. Like, I've never not done this. When my first movie was, you know, kind of a bit of a hit, I was encouraged, like, okay, now just do movies. And it was like, well, but what about all these other things that have been sustaining me, you know, and on all these different levels? Like, I really should just drop all of them because this is the thing, you know, that other people care about or that I could make money on. So it's something I do for myself first and foremost.
I think it's inspired a lot of jealousy, a lot of venom from people. I was reading on the back of your book, there's a blurb by Lena Dunham. And when I was doing research for this interview, I was actually shocked to learn how much you have in common with her in terms of haters. You know, you've inspired a lot of anti-fans. Do you think they have a problem with your work, or is it your ability to just do it all and succeed?
Yeah, at this point, I feel like I don't like that story, the story of haters, is almost, it's not that it's not true, but it's almost like media generated. Like, I think what Lena and I both experience is our extreme luck to be doing exactly what we want to do with a massive amount of supporters. And yeah, I'd say that neither of us is fitting into the exact way a woman is supposed to be. Like, if you're not perfect, and neither she nor I are perfect or perfectly sexy, then you're supposed to be a little bit apologetic about yourself. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're annoying.
I was actually wondering if it was female focused.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to Cheryl, because she's the female who is the focus of your book. In this novel, there's a lot of fetishism. There's this blurred lines between sex and violence, but in a very literary novel kind of way, very different from, let's say, 50 Shades of Grey. Okay.
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about the role that sexuality plays in this book and what you were exploring?
Yeah, well, it's so interesting because this character is actually almost asexual. I mean, she's in her 40s. She's pear-shaped. She's not beautiful. And I guess my way into her was into her sexual fantasies, which I got kind of fascinated by the fact that we do all these things in our sexual fantasies that don't reflect who we are on the outside or who we even want to be. I mean, I think that straight people have gay fantasies. I think that women, without even being aware of it, are often the man in a sexual fantasy, simply because you're thinking about the object of desire, which, whether it's you know, or another woman, you're thinking about how nice it feels for the man, you know, which is kind of the way that sex is sold to us. Like, the man is the one kind of having the most fun. And so in talking to friends very carefully and respectfully about this, and thinking about my own inner world, I realized, like, oh, I can have a character completely go off the hook without she herself needing to be freaky or radical in any way. I mean, she's quite a conservative woman, because that is actually how we are.
I'm speaking with the artist and filmmaker and author Miranda July. Her debut novel, The First Bad Man, is now out. It is a wickedly funny book that takes on fetishism, neuroses, motherhood, to the kind of inner dialogue that is running frequently inside of our heads. Well, there is a bit of a spoiler here, but through a weird chain of circumstances, Cheryl actually plays mother to a newborn in a certain point in this book. And there's this passage on page 220 that really struck me, and I'm wondering if you'd be willing to read it for us.
Right, sure. But as the sun rose, I crested the mountain of my self-pity and remembered I was always going to die at the end of this life anyway. What did it really matter if I spent it like this, caring for this boy, as opposed to some other way? I would always be earthbound. He hadn't robbed me of my ability to fly or live forever. I appreciated nuns now, not the conscripted kind, but modern women who chose it. If you were wise enough to know that this life would consist mostly of letting go of things you wanted, then why not get good at the letting go rather than the trying to have? These exotic revelations bubbled up involuntarily, and I began to understand that the sleeplessness and vigilance and constant feedings were a form of brainwashing, a process by which my old self was being molded, slowly but with a steady force, into a new shape, a mother. It hurt. I tried to be conscious while it happened, like watching my own surgery. I hoped to retain a tiny corner of the old me, just enough to warn other women with. But I knew this was unlikely. When the process was complete, I wouldn't have anything left to complain with. It wouldn't hurt anymore. I wouldn't remember.
Miranda July there, reading from her novel, The First Bad Man. I loved that passage because it seemed so authentic to the experience of a recent mother, you know, this sleep-deprived, all-consuming state of early parenting. And I read that you actually handed this book into the publisher just before giving birth yourself. Is that true?
Oh, well, better than that. I handed in the first draft, mm-hmm. so I had just gotten started. So I did, in fact, write, you know, did all my rewriting and most of the writing of the book in the first 2 years of my son's life.
Okay, so, well, that makes more sense to me because I wondered how you came up with the words that rang so true.
No, I waited. In fact, I wrote a little note to my editor in that first draft. I was like, I'm not even going to bother filling out the baby sections because next week I'll be a mom and I'll know, you know. It's funny. There was a lot more of myself that I thought was going to end up in the book in terms of being a mother. And it was a process of crossing things out because it's like you come out of this fever dream and you realize, oh, wait, I'm telling a fiction here. Hmm. And there are other stories besides my baby story.
You've starred in both of the feature films that you've made so far. I'm wondering if this book were turned into a movie, would you play Cheryl?
Oh, well, I'm not yet pear-shaped. I don't know if you were saying I was.
No, not at all.
I mean, I think
you could wear prosthetics. That's always good for, you know, getting a lot of good accolades.
Yeah, I don't know if you get an Oscar just for like a big butt. I think if they like age you, or
it's got to be a nose.
Or
something.
Yeah. Well, you know, I actually very consciously tried to make a story that didn't have a character that I could play because I feel like that's something I get to do in fiction. And when I'm making a movie thus far, I've always felt like I need to be in it. And therefore, I have to have a character that's pretty much like me because I'm not like a fantastically talented actress. I mean, I can do it, but I don't want to try out being like a working class British woman. Like, I think I'll, you know, stay close to home. So I thought of these characters as looking unlike me. But yes, you're right. I would play Cheryl sooner than I'd play Klee.
I think there are so many good options for Klee.
Yeah, I know.
Miranda July is an artist, a writer, a filmmaker, and whatever else she decides to be. You can find more about her novel, The First Bad Man, which is now out in paperback at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You've probably heard of the broken window theory. That's the idea that widespread vandalism and urban decay creates an atmosphere of lawlessness and spurs more crime. One thing the theory may overlook is the strange, often personal stories behind each shattered pane or spray-painted subway car. Roman Mars is host of 99% Invisible and brings us one such story.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars.
My name's Melissa Lee, and originally I'm from Hastings-on-Hudson, New York.
In a small town, I suppose you have to make your own fun.
Everybody makes their own fun. If you don't make it yourself, it ain't fun, it's entertainment.
I guess the big activity would be walking downtown after school, and you could hang out by the wall and watch people that you knew go by.
So not a lot going on in Hastings-on-Hudson, New York.
It's about 2 square miles, but it's right outside New York City, so it's sort of like, you know, there's a lot out there to do, but there's not actually a lot to do right where I was.
Besides people watching, Melissa and her friends would also collect geodes.
We did collect geodes, yes.
You know about geodes, right?
Break your own geodes.
The rocks are brown and lumpy on the outside, but when you smash them apart,
inside would be some crystalline structures. And you have no idea from the outside what you're getting, so you kind of have to take a chance on it, that inside you've got something great.
Usually Melissa and her friend Liz would buy a few geodes at the store downtown and take them home and smash them apart with a hammer. But one day, when Melissa was 13...
We were too impatient and we just had to know what was inside. There was a parking lot nearby and with an apartment building, and we decided to just throw it against the side of the wall as hard as we could and hope that it would crack open that way. And I think that was the first time that we had tried to open them that way without a hammer, just by throwing it. So I threw mine a few times, and finally it did crack open against the wall. And Liz kept throwing hers, and it wouldn't crack open. There was only one little window in this whole back of this apartment building. My friend Liz kept throwing hers, and
just a big expanse of brick.
And Liz kept throwing hers, and it wouldn't crack open. So I threw mine, and we saw it going towards the window, and then...
I mean, it felt like it was slow motion.
Her aim just went wild, and...
we're kind of like, no!
Then the geode
went through the window.
Breaking the glass and shattering it everywhere. We heard this huge crashing sound. Glass had broken and was now lying all over the parking lot floor, and the geode was inside. My first reaction was just pure, full-on fear. I hated doing things wrong. I hated getting in trouble. And I just got that terrible sinking feeling in my stomach, and I just wanted to get out of there. We were such good kids. I mean, this is what we did for fun. We broke open geodes. We never did anything wrong. And now we had committed this heinous act. And it was sort of like a quintessential wrong thing that kids can do. I mean, I always saw, you know, TV shows or read comic books where kids would break a window.
I did it.
And then they were faced with a dilemma. Do they go back and tell the guy that they did it or not?
Hey, let's get out of here!
We froze for about 10 seconds. And then my friend Liz ran forward. She reached into the broken glass and grabbed the geode, and we both ran. After initially running, some sort of moral compass started up, and we realized that we had to go back and we had to find this person and tell them what we did.
Melissa and Liz went back to the apartment building.
And we tried to figure out where the window led to. But when we went around to the front, it was very confusing which door might lead to that window. And so we knocked on a few doors. Everyone whose door we knocked on said that it wasn't their window. You know, we probably did that for 10 minutes. And then I think we were like, well, I think we did all that we can do. And we were probably really glad that we tried, but we weren't able to find out whose window it was in the end.
Still feeling guilty, Melissa avoided downtown and the window for a couple of months, which wasn't easy in a small town.
I thought that we would just go about our business and somebody would fix the window and I would never have to think about it again.
But when Melissa finally did go back to the window, it was still broken.
Like a cartoon, just like a, you know, jagged edge hole that was sitting there. Even the glass shards that had fallen into the parking lot were still lying there. It was pretty much like in pristine condition from the day that we had broken it until months and months later. It stayed almost exactly the same.
And it was clear that the apartment was occupied.
Actually, we could see a TV on inside sometimes. So we knew somebody did live there. And sometimes the window would be raised up or lowered down. So someone was moving this window around, but the hole was always still in it. We just could not even imagine who this person was that wasn't doing anything to fix this window. They weren't even putting tape over it. And we'd even go by in the winter and see that the hole was still there.
The window stayed broken as Melissa finished middle school, then finished high school.
It just hadn't gone away like I wanted it to.
Then went away to college.
And I was shocked to find that it was still broken, even after I'd left town.
And this became the pattern for Melissa. She'd go away, do some growing up. But when she came home, she'd see that window and feel exactly like the 13-year-old kid she was when she broke the window.
When I think about 13, that's like my most awkward, horrible age. The sight of this window would just bring me right back to feeling like a middle schooler again.
Melissa is 36 now. Think of all the milestones you pass between 13 and 36.
I went away to college for 4 years, and by the end of that, I felt pretty grown up.
Came home, saw the window, felt like a 13-year-old.
And then after that, I traveled the world for 9 months.
Came home, saw the window, felt like a 13-year-old.
I went to graduate school.
Came home.
I moved to Washington, D.C.
Saw the window.
I got married.
You get the idea.
As much as I was changing, this part of my past was completely frozen. As soon as I saw the window, I was just brought right back to those middle school days when we had broken it.
So in 2011,
when I'm about 35... years old.
22 years after she and her friend broke the window.
I decide to find out once and for all whose window it is and apologize. And I guess, you know, offer to pay for it as well. Now I'm recording this
time
for real.
I don't want to be mean to you.
So I go downtown with my sister accompanying me for courage. The hole is still there. in the window, and my heart is beating so fast.
Should I just say, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. I believe that, like, I know who broke that window.
He's right there.
Okay.
And I very, very nervously blurt out,
I'm sorry, I'm not trying to bother you. I'm just trying to actually make amends for, I think that years ago, I'm not sure, but I think my friend and I broke that window, and so I kind of just wanted to make amends for it.
You broke it?
I think so.
And you're telling me now?
Well, I actually tried to find you at the time, and I couldn't find you, and then 20 years later, I came back to my hometown. I left, you know, I haven't been back since then, and basically, that's what happened. So I just wanted to kind of find out, you know, whose it was. And
hi, Dina. How you doing?
How are you?
Good. She's been looking for me 20 years. She just said she found me. You believe it? For 20 years.
Well, I left town for a while.
But he didn't want to talk to me. He thought it was amusing that I was now fessing up. And when I offered to pay for it, he said,
window?
No, don't worry.
No? I'm surprised.
It's been like that so long. Everybody
I know. Well, why did you just decide to leave it like that? Get a nice breeze in the back there?
The landlord was supposed to fix it.
The landlord had never fixed it?
He never did. Well, he was looking for the person that did it.
And when I offered to pay for it, he said no, that he'd gotten used to it. He just left it.
I grew into that broken window, you did. In fact, I love it. I wouldn't get it fixed for nothing.
Anyway, I'm sorry, but I'm glad that you've come to like the broken window. My name is Melissa, by the way.
Okay.
Thank you. It was nice to meet you after all these years. I've wondered about it.
That's kind of an understatement.
Whatever it was that was keeping me, you know, stuck in middle school there, was sort of keeping him stuck with this broken window. And he just was content to live with it.
The broken windows theory proposed in 1982 says that a seemingly small act of vandalism, if it goes unfixed, can precipitate further vandalism and even more serious crime. That really didn't happen here, except for Melissa's life on the lam for 20 years. But the broken window did weigh on Melissa, and I'm guessing it affected the man in the apartment more than he's letting on, and a random passerby less so, and Hastings-on-Hudson, New York soldiered on without missing a beat. Architecture is personal. The strangest part of our interaction with the built environment is what can be so evocative and meaningful for you can mean absolutely nothing to someone else.
This time when I was in town, I just didn't really even... I think I was even in town for a few days before I even thought about the window. I didn't really even wonder about it very much. And then in the end, I didn't even go down and look.
That episode of 99% Invisible was produced by Roman Mars and Sam Greenspan. We're awful glad you could join us today. There is much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. That's where you can find your subscription to the Word of Mouth podcast. You can also sign up for it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please tell a friend and pass it around. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow, too, here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.